I don't know how to keep this thing open. Hey, everybody. Kevin, hey. Alcoholic.
Kevin. Hi, Kevin.
What's up, Kevin?
Kevin!
Look, Ma, I made it. This is it. This is the height of AA right here.
Yep.
My sobriety date is January 25th, 2017, so I'm a massive youngster. I shouldn't be up here yet, but that's the risk Brennan wants to take. Thanks, Brennan. It is an honor. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for accepting, bro.
And because I'm only 2 years sober, a lot of this stuff is fresh. It's raw. And so hopefully I can make it through without a tear, but don't hold it against me if I don't. I did just have my 2 year birthday, and if you guys missed it, we had a 2 year chip tour. Thanks to my tour manager, Jessica. We had tour t-shirts. There was a badass picture of me wrapped around a toilet with puke in my hair. And on the back was all the chip and cake meetings that I made. It was pretty extensive. It was a long tour, but it was a lot of fun. I was born in New Jersey, and I didn't spend much time there, but I've heard that's enough to make you an alcoholic. I was born to a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, beautiful sorority girl and a Division I basketball star. And so I think I was supposed to be a star football player, prom king. That's what it felt like. And I'm sure now looking back on it that was all in my head. But that's what it felt like. It was a very well-to-do family. I had no reason to be an alcoholic. They gave me everything I needed. I had no worries. Everything was very comfortable, and comfortable will be a theme in this, because I think that comfort is a disease. It was for me. I was born in New Jersey because my dad was a stockbroker, and he wanted to work on Wall Street, at least for a little bit. And as soon as I was popped out, he wanted to raise his family in California, so they got right back. If any of you are on any social media with me, you'll know that I use a little cartoon character as my profile picture. And there is a reason for that. It's just not because I didn't want to show my ugly mug. His name is Al Jolson. And Al Jolson, he's been my icon for way before I was in the rooms, well into my disease. And he didn't become really significant to me until these rooms, what I learned in these rooms. But if you've ever seen the cartoon was done, I believe, in the 1930s. It's a Looney Tunes, but it's a real rare one. And there's two owls, mother and father, and they're a strict religious family, a very musical family, and they're having four babies, four eggs, and they expect them to be great musicians that are only going to play in the church. So the first egg pops open, and it's a fantastic opera singer, and they're like overjoyed. The second egg pops open, and it's a virtuoso violin player, because owls are really advanced when they come right out of the egg. And the third egg is a flutist and plays like the heavens, and the parents are just overjoyed. Then the fourth one, bam, out pops Al Jolson, and he starts scatting and singing jazz. And the parents, back in the 30s, jazz was the forbidden rock and roll. And the parents are mortified. They can't believe that they have a son like this. So they immediately force him to sing church hymns, and he does it begrudgingly. But as soon as he has the chance, they look away. He goes back into the jazz, and they hear him, and they kick him out of the house, and he leaves the house and never comes back and goes on to a wonderful jazz career. By the end of the cartoon, everyone loves him, including his parents, because he persevered through who he was. And it always stuck with me. And it stuck with me because that was the opposite of me. I felt like I should have been something that I wasn't, but I wasn't ever willing to dive into who Kevin was. I pretty much had this image of what I should have been. I had the pressures to what I should have been on so many directions, and I conformed. And I did whatever I could to fall into that. And so I used Al Jolson because of my admiration for what that cartoon represented, because it was something that I have a lot of regrets about that I wish I could have done. as I was born, I felt like I was handed a checklist, and a lot of you hear this in my shares. I felt I was immediately handed a checklist of all the things that would make you happy in life. And I just, to gain happiness and to gain a meaning out of life, I had to start checking it off. And so, of course, there was getting good grades in school. There was going to college. There was buying a house. There was getting married. There was having three kids. I did all of that. And I was also handed something else. They said, here's a little zinger. You get alcoholism with you. And it took me a long time to admit that. But so I go off into life. And we're in San Jose, California. And I start elementary school. And I am, through elementary school, exactly what I'm supposed to be. I'm a cute little blonde-haired, blue-eyed kid who gets great grades, who does absolutely nothing wrong. And I have a great group of friends. I am just what was supposed to happen. And that goes along fine. But I am so darn immature. And I had, in the sixth grade, I got my first girlfriend because you were supposed to. That was on the checklist too, I forgot. And I was so immature. It was absolutely ridiculous. She was, for a sixth grader, she was ready to go to things that I was not ready to go to. And I was scared to death. I had no idea what I was doing, but I was supposed to do it. I was supposed to have a girlfriend. And I was scared to death. And the best day of my life was when she broke up with me. That was the pressure came off like you can't believe. I just wanted to go back to the basketball court and do stuff that I understood. And that advanced right into junior high. And junior high, for me, the only thing I could think of junior high was, oh my God, after PE, I have to shower. And everyone's gonna see that I have no grass anywhere on the infield. I look like a six-year-old, and here's all these dudes walking around, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm gonna be exposed for the two-year-old that I am. And I was scared to death. I didn't fit in with anyone. So I went from elementary school, I was popular, everything was going on, the grades were great. I hit junior high, and all my friends were advancing in ways that I had no ability to advance, that I couldn't help. I was scared to death. And so in junior high, most kids would cut class and go party somewhere and have fun. I swear to God that I cut class to go sit in my neighbor's backyard and avoid it all. And I would sit there and I would watch my clock to when school came out so I could safely go out and say I was out of school. That is how bad that I was scared. I didn't even remember that till I had found out I had to speak at this. Having to speak at this, I have learned so much, almost as much as I've learned by going through the 12 steps. And that was one thing that I had completely shoved out of my mind, that I would actually cut class to avoid life, to isolate at that young of an age. My grades dropped dramatically out of nowhere. And because I was in a situation where it was how you looked and not how you felt, my mom started doing my homework just to make it look good. And it was another way for me to isolate and not do stuff. Junior high was not fun. But you couldn't tell on the outside. I was jovial. I was a class clown. I was getting by on that, but I was completely confused inside, and I didn't know what to do about it other than hide and pretend that everything was okay, and when the pressure got too much, to jam. Then I rolled it right into high school, and high school was the same thing. I was just so immature. I didn't have coping skills. I just wanted to avoid everything and pretend everything was okay. I wasn't accepted in the stoners, I wasn't accepted in the athletes, and I wasn't accepted in the guys that floated in between. And it wasn't their fault, it was me, I was scared of them all. And so I existed in them all. I just traveled around. I'd be with the popular kids for a bit, and then I'd go to the smoking section, then I'd go over to the kids that just were doing it, and that's how I existed. And it was confusing. I floated through. I remember every time my parents would talk to the teachers, we'd go, "We don't know why this kid doesn't get good grades. We don't know why he doesn't do this. We don't know why he doesn't do that." I absolutely loved playing soccer. Soccer was my respite. It was something that I was good at, something that I enjoyed, and I tried out for the soccer team in my sophomore year and made it. And I started to do well again, and I was loving playing it, but I would always self-sabotage, and that was the only time I tried out for the soccer team, because I won most improved. And I'm like, what the hell, most improved? Well, of course I won most improved, because they had no idea that I could even play, because I was hiding so much, and so I was offended of getting most improved, because I thought that meant I at once sucked and then got good. That's an alcoholic mind right there, you know, instead of just taking that and saying, you know, that's, you got an award, keep on pushing forward, get to be the best that you could. I didn't. I took it as a slight and another excuse to quit. So I get through high school by the skin of my teeth. And of course, on the checklist is go to college. I had wanted nothing to do with school, absolutely nothing. One thing that I was damn good at was working. I loved money, I loved getting a paycheck, and that's all I wanted to do. I wanted to make money, get a paycheck, but that was not gonna happen in my family. It's not their fault, it's their fault. They wanted the best for their son, it's not their fault. I just never put my foot down to live my own life. And so I went to junior college, and I was feeling empty. I wasn't drinking alcoholically yet. I was drinking. I think it was binge drinking, because once alcohol hits my lips, I don't really have the ability to stop. But I wouldn't define it as alcoholically yet. I was lost. I knew I wanted something, because I have a drive in me, and thank God I do. But I have a drive, and I didn't know what it was. And so I knew I had to get out of town. Probably my first ever geographical. Probably my only one. Maybe number two. I told my parents, I got to go to Europe. Something's got to kick me in the ass. Something's got to change. I got to go to Europe. And I was scared to ask them, because I didn't know. I thought for sure it would be no. I don't know why. And they said, hell yes. Something's got to happen here. And they sent me off to London. I got to London. It was really the first thing I did out of my super comfort zone. Thank you. And I landed in London. I didn't know anyone there. It's a bunch of students. We were studying at the University of London. I didn't know anyone there. That was very, very scary. And here I was in a different country. And yeah, the language was a real problem. I flippin' loved it. I didn't have the pressures of home. I was basically, I was dating my wife to be, and she was a spitting image of my mother. They both have an idea of who Kevin was, and that's what I tried to live up to. So in London, I had no pressures. I'm a music freak, and all of the music that I loved was coming out of London at the time. It was the time of the Manchester scene. Acid House was just hitting, and I found a group of friends, and we were out every single night. It was unbelievable. I started drinking more, but it was still an okay level of drinking. I blossomed like you can't believe. I learned so much. We ran all over Europe, didn't have much money, and somehow we would open up the New Times as the, not the New Times, sorry. I don't remember the name of it now. Is it the Times? It's the entertainment periodical in London. And we would go down, and anything that was free, we would highlight all the free stuff. And then the band or the nightclub with the weirdest name, we would go to that show. And it was awesome. We went all over that place. We went all over Europe. And it just kind of happened. I grew so much. I became as the closest I think I would ever be to me at that time. I learned some hard things. I learned that... I'm trying to figure out if this is my perception or if it was reality. I learned that women really are looking for tall, dark, and handsome. That sucked. That was a reality that sucked. Because I tried and it wasn't happening. It was bad. But I learned another reality. It was the opposite with the gay crowd. I was right in their niche, man. I was freaking popular, and those guys are aggressive. So, I told you one story. I won't tell that story. That's a good one, though. I got to learn real quick, because I was so immature, I got to learn real quick whether I was gay or not, because I had that on the table. And unfortunately, I would have had a really good sex life. But I couldn't get over the female form, and it was who I was. So I couldn't get over the female form. It was too beautiful and too attractive, and so there I was, stuck with what didn't want me. Where do I go from there? That's it. But that trip, I came back, and I remember landing back in the United States, and it was a different world, and I don't know, it just changed so much. I felt more confident. I felt like I could tackle things. I was really coming in. I had grass on the infield by then. That was huge. Wasn't much of an infield, but it could play ball. So I came back. It was the best thing I ever asked for. It did for me what I had hoped. It got more worldly. I had experiences that changed me forever. I had friends that I still have to this day. It was all that. But I fell right back into what I call the delusion. I fell back into it real quick. It was time for a four-year school. And because I am so strong and I really paved my own way, my mother chose my university and she chose my major. I was right back in it, like it had never gone away. And that brought me to Cal Poly. And that's why I stand before you now, because I never wanted to leave. But I got to Cal Poly, and that's where the drinking really started. I was really into music, like I said, and so the first thing I did was, instead of go find out where my classes were, I ran to the radio station and became a DJ. That's what I wanted to do. So I was a DJ all 3 years I was there. And I floated through. I was in a fraternity, and the fraternity was absolutely perfect for me because we were the absolute misfits, and we were only bound by one thing: drinking. We could all do it. We could all do it well. And we could laugh when someone didn't do it well. And a lot of those guys are still my friends, but it was the bottom line that. And I rose to the top of that fraternity and became president. And during my presidency, a kid drank so much at a party that he holds the San Luis Obispo County record for alcohol percentage. Anyone want to take a guess?
0.61.
Wow. What he had done was, we had this Christmas party, and it was where the president would not be president that night, and he would be Santa Claus, and the vice president would take over the responsibility. And all the gifts, of course, were alcohol, and every gift that was alcohol, the president had to take a shot. And then he got to have two elves, which were two of the little sisters, because we were so politically correct. And if you wanted to pass one of the shots, you could use the little sisters. So you choose the girls that could really do it, really down the alcohol. And so I was unaware of what was happening at that party. And he came in completely blitzed and then wanted to show off and poured Wild Turkey 101 into a 32-ounce Big Gulp cup and downed it. And this is after he was already hammered. And he passed out into their arms. And they were, thank God, they were smart enough to throw him in the back of a pickup truck and get him to the hospital wearing their letters. So the doctors took the guy in and then immediately called the cops. And it was an absolute fiasco. I made the front page of the Tribune as the president. And all the confidence I had building up and all the stuff that was going for me, it crushed me. I had to talk to the press every day and try to explain a situation that politically at the time was so bad. All the fingers pointing at us. It was terrible. I started really drinking then. I would hide in my room, literally hide. I had a futon that would fold up to this thing, and you could hide behind it. I literally slept like in a taco, so that when the press and the cops, wherever, would come in and talk to me and take me down and interview me, they couldn't find me. Didn't go to class. It was quite a time, because I had to step down as a symbolic gesture to step down as the president, even though I had nothing really to do with it. He was 21. But I'll get past that. It was just a bad time. It knocked me for a loop. And I really started drinking. And so even guys in this fraternity that was always drinking whispered to me, you might want to slow down a little bit. And for those guys to say that, it must have been really something. But I ended up finishing Cal Poly. And as soon as I finished Cal Poly, I rushed back with my to-be wife to live in San Jose. And I was bartending at the time, perfect job. And looking for a legitimate job, my major was environmental management. And I was trying to find a job in that field. But I don't know how hard. Now, looking back on it, I don't know how hard, because I didn't want to stop drinking. And bartending was so, you know, you had cash in your hand every night. Plus, you got to drink. I haven't figured out completely if I self-sabotaged myself to keep myself in that bartending gig, or if I really was trying to find a job. But 3 months after that, calls one of my college friends, not a fraternity brother, but a college friend, and he said, "I'm opening up a bar nightclub in San Luis Obispo, and you're perfect. Why don't you come manage it for me?" And that was Mother's Tavern. And I said, "Hallelujah!" I get to go back to the Central Coast, and I get to run a nightclub bar. And I asked my fiance at the time. I said, "You want to do it?" And she said, "Heck yeah!" So we came, and that's what brought us. That's why I'm here today. So I went to worked Mother's the first 8 years, drinking every single night and driving home every single night. I think maybe 6 nights a week, but you know that business. If anyone knows that business, it's 6 days a week, and then they call you in on the seventh. I was working 11 in the morning till 3:30 in the morning every day. It was brutal. And then about halfway through that, I was married, and my wife got pregnant with Ivy, sweet little thing over there. And they let off my hours a little bit, and it was really good, because I got to walk her every day, and I got to be a dad for a lot, but a lot of it, I was drinking every single night, and it was the same old thing that so many of us do. I ain't drinking tonight. I am not drinking tonight. And about 10 o'clock every night, it was bam, game on every single night. How I got home every night, having to go look over at my wife, and she'd go, "You freaking stink. Will you stop? Please stop. You are," I was disgusting. But I figured, I'm working my ass off here. I'm raising a family. I'm making good money. I deserve this shit. I deserve it all, and so I would not stop. I'd stop in my head during the day, and it would never happen at night. But I was getting demoralized, because I did not want to drink every night. I did not. I swore I did not. But every morning, I could smell myself. I could smell I remember getting the call that we all get from the dentist. "You have a dentist appointment tomorrow?" And I'd be so scared of them. I don't want them to smell me. I gotta open my mouth and they gotta go in. I don't want them to smell me. I will not drink tonight. And then that morning, wake up and go, "Oh my God, I gotta go to the dentist." And I'm gonna open up and they're gonna freaking be mortified. I was so embarrassed, but nothing like that could make me stop. It got worse and it got worse. I remember going to the bathroom at night, usually when the night was ending, and looking in the, I never did, but I just, for some reason, I felt like I was gonna pee blood. I just felt so bad inside. I felt so rotten. I was always amazed, oh my God, it's regular pee. But I felt like I was drinking that much and I felt that horrible, physically and mentally. And finally, I got my first blessing that I didn't heed. I got a DUI. I was going home. We had moved to Santa Maria, so it was a longer drive. And I was going home, and I was going 98 in my Civic and got pulled over. And I was .32. And because I was going 98, the one thing I remember is walking out of jail in the morning and my wife pulling up in the Ford minivan, two kids Josh was born by now, two kids in high chairs and me walking out of the jail and getting into a frickin' minivan with two kids in the back. Oh my God. How did life get to this? Seriously, how did life get to this? I'm supposed to be this guy that owns a house, which I did, who's supposed to be respectable, who's supposed to be doing, supposed to be making his parents proud, supposed to be having a gleaming wife, and here I am walking out of jail with my head hung low into a freaking minivan with two seats in the back, two kids happy to see me, not even knowing what the hell dad was. And because I was going 98, I had to do 6 weekends in jail. The sheriffs used to laugh because I still looked like I was 12. And they would say, we're going to have to watch you, man, because this is not for you. And I thought they meant that I was so tough they were scared I was going to kick someone's ass, but they didn't mean that. They were scared that something was going to happen to me. And because I had learned to hide in that futon, I learned how to hide in that bunk, too. And So I had to come in here. I had to come in here on a court card, and I absolutely hated it. I thought you guys were a bunch of people hanging on for dear life with a cigarette and coffee and just holding on. I'm going to be sober. And I was so unready to be sober that this was the Star Wars bar. All you guys were ugly. I got my court card signed, and I got the hell out. And I was so unready. And so I did quit, though. I white-knuckled it for several years. I don't remember if it was absolutely miserable. I don't remember what white-knuckling it was like. I just did it. I quit Mothers, and I started off into IT, which I still do now, which was the best decision I ever made. And I just worked and worked and worked and worked. And I guess it was fine. It went for several years. And this is not your fault, Josh. This is just circumstance. But my son was one hell of a soccer player, and so he made traveling soccer. And I thought, this is so badass, because I freaking love that sport. And I said, I get to travel around and watch my son play high-level soccer. This is unbelievable. So we started doing that. And because us goddamn alcoholics are so damn smart, I figured, oh my God, I'm not around my family. This kid's too young to realize it. I can drink and no one will know. And that's what I did. I started drinking. We'd enjoy his games in the day. We'd try to do something after the games, and then we'd get to the hotel room, and I thought he didn't see it, but Lord knows he saw it. He knew exactly what was going on, and he just wanted to have fun with his friends, so he let Dad sit in the corner of the hotel room and get drunk every single tournament. At this point, I had a corporate job, and I was traveling a bit, and so when I'm traveling on the corporate job, I'm by myself too. And so I start drinking on the corporate job, not on the job, at night in the hotel room. And that sufficed. I would look forward to those trips every single time. I would look forward to them like a little kid in a candy store, a little kid getting to go to Disneyland. I was so excited I'd get to drink. And it progressed. So then it wasn't enough. And so being a lying sack of crap that I am, I ended up faking business trips and saying, I'm gone. I got to go on a business trip. And I would sit in my office in Orchid and use that for drinking time. And I started doing that more and more and more. And so eventually I was in that office drinking, and I thought I got caught. My wife texted me and said, where are you at? I went, oh my God, this is a tough question. And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I said, I better get to where I'm supposed to be, and I better get there fast. The problem is that I'm an Orchid, and I'm supposed to be in the Mojave Desert. I could choose a lot better roads than 166 to be drunk on, that's for sure. So I made it pretty far. I made it to 5. And I don't know if it was because I was drunk or if I actually fell asleep, but I would have fallen asleep because I was drunk. So either way, it was because I was drunk. But I ended up in front of a semi the wrong way. And the impact of the accident sent me into the middle of an agriculture field. Now, if you drive 166, drive 166 and try and find a place to safely go off that road. There ain't many of them, man. There ain't many of them. Most of them are they're bad. And so, because I did that after that. I said, how did I end up in the middle of an agriculture field? But I did. And I woke up, I didn't know where I was, what was happening. I just trying to push a door that had been smashed in. Somehow I ended up out of the car. And I walked out of the car, and I had no idea. I could have killed a family in a station wagon. I had no idea what had happened. But this inner peace came over me. I looked back at the car and I went, holy shit, smashed in. And I got this inner peace and I said, oh my God, I don't have to lie anymore. I'm totally exposed. There's no running away from this situation. There is nothing I can do about this situation to lie about it. There's absolutely nothing I can do. Thank God. It was so relieving. And I thought I was gonna go one of two ways. My whole family would just be over it and just be done and say, adios, bro, we're going off to a better life. You're done, you're a loser, get out of our life. Or they would stick with me and I could maybe find a solution to sobriety that I really honestly didn't think existed. So the latter happened and they stuck with me. I couldn't believe it, honestly. I lost my corporate job, and I told my wife, let's go over to AA. You have to go with me, because I got to show you how bullshit it is. And if you don't see it yourself, you're going to be nagging me that you need to be over there, and so you need to see how bad it is, so that we can move on to something that possibly could work. And I showed up at Glenn's podium meeting on a Friday night. We went to the Spanish-speaking one first, which was classic. And about 10 guys tried to tell me in Spanish that I was in the wrong place. We finally got up and got over to this meeting, sat right back there. And it was Dank still talks about it, what an incredible meeting that was. People come up to me. It was just one of those things where you guys were not going to let me go until I understood that this is where I belonged. There was no way you guys were going to let me go. It was extremely touching, incredibly profound and important. And Glenn handed me a big book. Everyone signed it. Hugs, tears. I was hooked on that first meeting. The second meeting, it was that Jessica smile moment. I needed hope the second meeting. The first meeting, I needed clarity that this was the place to be. The second meeting, I needed hope. If there wasn't hope in this, if it was really gripping with a cigarette and coffee and just going, please let me, if it was like that, I didn't want anything of it. And something in Jessica's smile, I don't know what it was, told me that there is damn hope in this. It is an awe moment because it was that important. I needed something that told me there was hope. I needed some sign, and God came through her smile and just said, this is, there's hope here, there's a life. Because I didn't come in these rooms, the last thing I came in these rooms was just to survive. I had done that my whole life and just to have a mundane life. I came in here to finally hit the pedal to the metal because I had blamed my drunkenness and my insobriety on me not getting to where I was supposed to be. I had this checklist, I had done the whole checklist. I had completed the whole damn thing. I had this emptiness inside me. It did not fulfill me, although I have the best kids in the absolute frickin' world, and I'll put them up against any of yours. I love them. I don't regret anything of what had happened, and it wasn't anyone's fault. It wasn't my parents' fault. It wasn't my wife's fault. It wasn't society's fault. It wasn't. It was that I didn't have the balls to live my own life. I didn't have the balls to break out and say, hey, this ain't me. I need to start doing what I'm doing, if whether it's respected, whether it's liked, whether it's under this stuff. I needed to be Al Jolson. I needed to be that owl and just get out there and find out who Kevin was. But I chose for so long not to do that. So I get in to AA and I start listening, and that's all I did. First 6 months, that is all I did. She'll tell you. She'll tell you. It was wonderful. I was hearing things that I had never heard in my life. I was hearing a different language completely. I told Matt it was Swahili. And I was like, what are these people talking about? This is the strangest stuff. But they're freaking happy. There's hope in here. I'm just going to keep on listening. And I kept on listening. And I kept on listening. I just stayed quiet. And I would get here right at the time the meeting started and bail as fast as I could, whether someone said hello to me or not. And it didn't mean I didn't want to meet you guys. I wanted to meet you guys so freaking bad. I wanted to be part of your club. I wanted to be part of this society. I wanted to be pulled into the herd. And if you're a newcomer and you feel that same way, you're sitting on the outside and you're saying, man, I want to be part of these guys, but I have no idea how. I found out how. You do two things. You wash the coffee cups. Nate will say hi to you if you do the wash, because that's the first thing that happened. I found out you guys will come up and say hi to me and talk to me if I wash the coffee cups. And then the biggest mistake I made, if I didn't want to stay sober, was I mentioned to Joe Kay and I mentioned to Luke that I was having trouble meeting people. Oh, God. I walked up to the, it was Jessica at the time. Luke walked up to Jessica and at the Lion's Den and said, I have a new greeter for you. And she said, we already have enough greeters. We have two. She says, now you have three. And they started pulling me into commitments, and I had commitments left and right, and that is so important for me. If I'm going to stay sober, I've got to have commitments, and I've got a lot of commitments right now. Not as many as Nate, but I'm working on it. I started having commitments. I started, you guys pulled me into the herd. I had to be pulled in, and thank the Lord you guys did. And so I'm listening, and then I'm starting to share a little bit more and more, and I'm getting some of these things out of my system, and I'm reading. I chose my first sponsor. I chose him for a reason. He was great, but he wasn't getting me to where I wanted to be. I started wanting to be really healthy. I started wanting to see what you guys had and see if I started doing what you guys were saying full time. I was listening, I was reading, I was very book smart. I had it all down. I knew how to talk, but I wasn't implementing it in my life. And so I knew I had to make that switch. That was the next switch I had to make. And I had gone through step 4 and 5 with my first sponsor. It didn't feel right. I think I was starting to get a higher power, and the higher power pushed me to, and I do not break up with people well. I don't, and it was very hard. And so I called him and I said, you know what? I have to change sponsors. You've been great, but I have to change sponsors. He goes, holy crap, dude, I thought you did that 2 months ago. And he didn't even know that I hadn't done it. So I was all stressed about it, and he already thought I had moved on. So I got an absolutely gorgeous hunk of a man for a sponsor, and started doing the... If I would have met him in London, it would have been game on. So I started doing the steps, and it felt right. I was listening to people that were blowing my mind. I used to drink, and I never used. That was never one of my my story. For some reason, all through the London, drugs were huge. College drugs were huge. I never used. I was scared. I knew I would like them. I knew that alcohol was a problem enough, and I just never used them. I don't know why. I can't explain to you why. It's halfly because I knew that it would have been terrible. So I started listening to the people, and I drank to blow my mind. I drank to get out of Kevin and to blow my mind and hopefully get to a place that was much better than here. I had no idea that words out of drunks and alcoholics would be the thing that would blow my mind. It started blowing my mind. I couldn't really expound on what I was hearing. I just knew that I had to soak it in, and I started soaking it in. And then about 9 months, I was driving down Broadway, and it was just a regular day. I was going to a client's house, song playing on the radio, regular Broadway scene, nothing beautiful. and I looked to the side, and the whole world tilted. You know, like those ViewMasters, those things that we're aging ourselves. Everyone nodding is aging themselves. It was almost like the ViewMaster went an inch over, and everything switched. And I went, what the hell happened? And I looked at the radio, and the same song was on. I was still on Broadway. Nothing had changed, but this whole well-being came over me. Like, man, you're gonna be okay. Everything's gonna be okay. You can screw up. You can take risks. You can do whatever you want. But right at this moment, from here on out, you are okay. I had never felt that in my life, and that's why I knew that something had happened. You can call it a spiritual awakening. I will never call it a spiritual awakening, because I was so damn asleep that if I was that asleep and didn't know it, then how do I know I'm awake? I could still be terribly asleep. And I think it's Adyashante. Is that how you pronounce it, Matt?
Adyashante.
He says, when you have a true spiritual awakening, the seeker will stop. And my seeker hasn't stopped. My seeker is on full time right now. I am seeking like you can't believe. This place has taught me, has given me an intellectual desire for the spiritual that has taken the place of any drug could do, any alcohol could do. It is the exploring the mystery of life and living in the mystery of life is unbelievable. I can't believe I lived so damn long, so with blinders on, and didn't know what an absolutely beautiful place I'd been birthed into. Just the opportunity to be alive and present and conscious blows my mind nowadays. I have taken a complete change, and it is 100% due to that big book speaking to me like no other book ever has. Doing the 12 steps successfully. I didn't do them perfect, that's for damn sure, but I did them really pretty good. And this fellowship means the absolute world to me. I love this fellowship and every single soul in it with everything in my heart. And that's not lip service. That ain't lip service, man. I look forward to these meetings. I look forward to out-of-town meetings. I look forward to being a part of this every single day because it feels unbelievable. If you are new, I thought it was bullshit too, if you think that. I just didn't think it was for me. I didn't think that there was anything that could cure my type of alcoholism. I thought that as long as you guys didn't know I was a drunk, that everything was okay. I could hide it. I could do everything I could to act like I was supposed to act and have the things I was supposed to have. And as long as you guys didn't know it, I was going to live the rest of my life as a miserable, anxiety-ridden alcoholic. Thank God to this program that I didn't end up that way, because I could have missed this all. I could have missed every piece of it, and I didn't, thanks to you guys pulling me into the herd, being as loving and gracious as you guys are. I love you extremely deeply, and I'm very grateful to be here. That's all I got.